Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal and New York officials held a news conference just a few minutes ago to answer questions about Faisal Shahzad, the Connecticut man of Pakistan descent, arrested in the failed Times Square car bomb attempt as his plane was about to take off from New York's JFK airport. Here's Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano.
They pulled the flight back, as you know, to the gate. They also had the authority, if the flight had actually taken off, to order the plane to turn around and come back.
Attorney General Eric Holder also said that Shahzad admitted his involvement. Michael Shear is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Michael, we know police traced Shahzad through the car he bought from a college student. He gave her a fake name, cash, but his real cell phone number. So officials were on to him, and he'd also, we heard today, gone through some screening after he returned from a recent trip to Pakistan and was on a terror watch list. So did we get a satisfactory answer? How is it that he was able to get on an airplane?
Yeah, you know, those are the questions I think that are going to be really front and center over the course of the next few days. That, you know, we didn't get a lot of satisfactory questions. I think the Attorney General used the phrase "the investigation is still ongoing" maybe a dozen times. One of the things that folks are going to be looking at closely is what lists was this fellow on? He's obviously an American citizen, so you know, what lists was he on? What checkpoints and moments that might have gotten the government onto him were potentially missed.
We heard earlier in the day that because he bought his ticket or made his reservation on the way to the airport, he may have not triggered the system quickly. And then when he paid for his airplane ticket with cash, that did set off alarm bells. But at any rate, a very tense situation at the airport. What does Attorney General Holder say Shahzad is going to be charged with?
Well, at least initially, he laid out three charges: one international terrorism, one attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, and then crossing national borders with intent to harm. And so, you know, at least as a first cut, those are the things that we'll see him charged with.
He was born in Pakistan, but is an American citizen who's been living in Sheldon, Connecticut. In fact, the AP is reporting that court records show he defaulted on his mortgage and his home was in foreclosure. But do we have a sense of whether or not what process he went through? Was he Mirandized?
Yeah, we do know that. After they took him off of the plane, they questioned him under some exceptions that the government can use to question a terror suspect without Mirandizing him. They did that. They got what they said was good information out of that, transferred him somewhere else, Mirandized him, and then apparently he continued to talk even after that. They would say very little about what exactly he said other than acknowledging that he implicated himself in this incident.
We had heard in the past that terror suspects, when they are Mirandized, often then start to use information they have as leverage because they know they're going to be, be tried. But do we know anything more about three other men who were reportedly taken off the plane with him?
Yeah, my understanding, I can't remember if they mentioned it at this press conference, but that the folks taken off the plane were eventually cleared, that those folks were not part of the investigation. We have had reports of some arrests in Pakistan. The Attorney General was asked about that and essentially declined to comment on the extent to which that is obviously connected to this.
But there have been reports, in fact, NPR is reporting that a source has told them that there has been an arrest in Pakistan. What else in the less than a minute that we have, Michael, what else did you hear today that perked your ears up?
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting thing and the question that's on everybody's mind is, you know, how long they had him in their sights, apparently much longer than maybe we all realized, and how they tracked him and why, if they were tracking him, they let him get on the plane. Your clip at the beginning said that the Homeland Security Secretary said, well, we could call the plane back. But I think for regular folks, the idea of letting a plane eventually take off would certainly seem like a risky thing.
Yeah. Unless, of course, course, you were tracking other people as well and didn't want to give the alert.
Didn't want to grab him until you were finished with that. So,
Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, on today's development in the Times Square car bomb attempt. Michael, thank you so much.
Sure.
So how bad is it? I'm speaking of the Gulf oil slick. There are still fears that it will engulf the Gulf shore, but winds have kept it away from the current that could carry it to the Florida Keys. Efforts to contain the oil with booms appear to be working better. Crews are also reporting progress, breaking up the offshore oil using chemical dispersants. But as we're going to hear in a few minutes, those dispersants have their own environmental costs. So is this apocalypse now, apocalypse pending, or maybe not at all? New York Times reporter John Broder co-wrote a story today in the Times. The title is Bad, but Maybe Not an Apocalypse. He joins us from Washington, D.C. John, one expert you spoke with gave you a sports metaphor for where we are now in the Gulf. Let's hear that.
Right. He said it's the first inning of a nine-inning game. Of course, it could go into overtime as well, into extra innings, but there's no way to predict how bad this is going to be. It's definitely bad, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons spilling into the Gulf from deep undersea as we speak, but there's no way to predict where it's going to end up and what the long-term impact is going to be.
Well, give us just some of the variety of things that you're hearing from people who are very deep in marine biology. You know, it ranges from the sky isn't falling to it is. Just give us a sense of that.
Well, I mean, probably the darkest scenario that's painted in that story is what is happening far offshore now and at significant depths in the Gulf. There's a lot of animal life there. If you take a mason jar out from the middle of the Gulf, you'll find hundreds of organisms in it, some of which actually may end up helping to eat the oil, so, because some organisms do. But they could be larvae for fish or marine mammals that could be permanently altered. The nightmare for most people is this slick congealing and moving in toward the shore and fouling beaches, fouling ports, and destroying fisheries for, you know, a significant amount of time into the future.
Or, as we said, getting caught up in that Gulf Stream current loop and going down around the Keys. And we were told yesterday by one analyst maybe even being carried off to Europe. So, there's that. And we want to underscore that no one you spoke to is saying what, for instance, Rush Limbaugh is saying, which is that, oil is natural and there's no problem here.
Nobody's saying that at all. But some experts are saying that, one, there are fairly sizable seeps, as they're called, which is naturally bubbling up oil from the subsurface, from underneath the base of the ocean up into the water on any given day. There was a huge spill off the Mexico coast in 1979. It eventually dispersed. It left some black, tarry stuff on the beaches, which eventually got picked up. But marine life came back, and that's the important thing that the marine biologists point out. That's not to minimize or apologize for what's going on out there. It's a disaster, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But it may not be the end of the Gulf as we know it.
And as we keep saying it, it's the first of several innings of this horrible game, if you will. But it also reminds us of other spills, because President Obama said that it's not a spill. It's a gushing river of oil coming out of this uncapped and leaking well, is a potentially unprecedented environmental disaster. Now, he says potentially, and that's key. But what's the precedent now? Just give us a sense of how big the previous spills were.
Well, the one that I mentioned in Mexico 30 years ago was 140 million gallons. We're over a nine-month period. What we're looking at is roughly a million gallons every 5 days, if the Coast Guard and National Oceanic Administration is correct, at around 200,000 gallons a day. The Exxon Valdez was 11 million gallons of a heavy crude spilled near into the shore, and it did in fact create a very gooey, sticky, toxic black tide that washed over 1,000 miles of shore, killed countless birds and mammals.
And it was a heavier oil too.
It was, and it tended not to evaporate, and it couldn't burn. They're hoping to resume at least some test burns in the next couple of days as the seas calm down.
Well, and you also mentioned that when retreating, Iraqi forces spilled millions of gallons of oil in the Persian Gulf in 1991. That was one of the world's worst oil disasters. But people have asked, so I'll ask you, was that directly into the Gulf?
No, not all of it, of course. What they did is they destroyed wells, they destroyed terminals, they blew up tankers. So I haven't seen a good estimate of how much actually went into the Gulf and how much of it went up into the toxic black smoke that you all remember seeing pictures of as the Iraqi forces retreated. But, you know, even given the magnitude of that, and much of it, I'm sure, did flow into the Gulf at some time, there's still an active fishery in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, well, John Broder, again, of the New York Times, thought he'd hold up the Gulf oil disaster and sort of examine it from different sides and compare it to other disasters, at least at this stage. And for doing that, some readers are really taking you to task for appearing to downplay the scope of this. You say that's not what you're doing.
That's not what I'm doing at all. There is a strong possibility that this will continue for months while BP and its partners try to cap it or drill a relief well. And the impact could be very long-lasting, economic and environmental. But it could also turn out to be not as bad as the doomsayers say. And I just want to raise that possibility.
Well, and you also...
We've had 10 days of highly negative coverage and predictions of apocalypse, and that's only one possible outcome.
Right. Of course, it's... You know, and it's the worst one. But you also point out that after the Ixtoc spill in Mexico 31 years ago, the second largest oil release in history, the Gulf there, you say, did rebound?
That's what the marine biologists tell me. You know, I obviously don't have any firsthand knowledge. One scientist told me that, you know, you can still get tar on your feet in Padre Island that can be traced back to that spill. But it could also be traced back to a natural seep as well, you know, one of these underground little springs, as it were, of oil that's coming up from the Earth's core.
Mm.
It's not a good thing, you know, the animals don't like it, but many organisms do, in fact, adapt to it.
Well, and yet another point that readers make is that we don't really know what's going on in the Gulf. There are so many different estimates. Oceanographer Ian McDonald at Florida State says he thinks it's more like 1 million gallons is pouring out of that well every day. And that would mean that this has already surpassed Exxon Valdez in the amount spilling out.
In the amount, but not necessarily the type. It's a lighter crude, and it's dispersed in much deeper and much more water. Again, I don't want to suggest that the old saying, the solution to pollution is dilution. But it is diluted, and it's getting churned up. It's being turned into this moussey, light, frothy substance, which, best case scenario can be corralled, burned, or carted off. Worst case scenario, it gets into the marshes and the gulfs and the white sand beaches and ruins everybody's day.
Right, in a bad way. And also we should mention the dispersants seem to be breaking up at least the slick, as they're supposed to do. But as we're about to hear in a minute or so, they have their own side effects.
Absolutely.
Yeah. John Broder, New York Times Washington correspondent covering energy and environmental issues. We'll link you to his story today, trying to take a step back look at the tragedy, the disaster in the Gulf, and put it in some perspective, at least for today. John, thanks so much.
Anytime, Robin.
And just ahead, we'll take a look at those chemicals and those dispersants BP is using to break up the oil slick. Are they potentially more dangerous than the oil to the environment? And later, how soap operas are changing cultures, particularly one from Turkey, impacting Arab countries. But we'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the Gulf oil slick. BP has bought up a third of the world's supply of dispersants to break up the oil slick. But there are questions. Might that world supply run out, even though BP has used about 100,000 gallons of dispersants to break up the oil slick, and it seems to be working? And will there be needed something to disperse the dispersants. The online investigative news site ProPublica is reporting that the chemicals being used to break up the oil are toxic themselves and could possibly be worse for the environment than oil. Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica joins us now. And Abram, before we get to some of the environmental concerns, how do these dispersants work?
The dispersants are a chemical solution, and they essentially break up the oil. They take it from a gooey mass that tends to all stick to itself and break it up into tiny little bubbles that can then move both horizontally across the water surface like the oil does, but also drop down into the water column itself and essentially can spread out in three directions instead of two. The idea being the faster it spreads out and the less it sticks together, the less harm it will pose to wildlife, shorelines, seabirds, things like that.
And we understand a little of the dispersant goes a long way?
It does. I'm told that a gallon can be spread over as far as 5 acres. It's not exactly clear how they're using it, and I am led to believe they're using it in much higher quantities, especially as they're injecting it underground. But a very small amount could potentially go a long way.
Well, now tell us about that part, the injecting underground. We heard reports yesterday that BP had reached out to other oil companies like ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil said to BP, you should inject these dispersants right into the actual well, not just on the surface of the water. Tell us more about that.
That's exactly what they're doing now. Normally, dispersants are sprayed on the surface. They're dropped from an airplane or they're sprayed from a fire hose or something along those lines. What they want to do now or have begun doing is injecting the dispersant straight into the riser pipe that's coming out of the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico in the hopes that by the time the oil comes out into the water, it is already in the process of dispersing, of breaking into small molecules and sort of wafting away like a cloud of mist rather than a stream of oil.
Okay, but we spoke to someone from the MIT Technology Magazine who said that he felt that that could be one of the problems because dispersant injected directly into the well will make it more pressurized, will make the oil come out faster.
Nobody that I've spoken with on this has presented the situation as anything other than a choice between two evils. No one claims that dispersants are a risk-free process or completely without any environmental harm. It's simply important to remember that they do come with their own environmental impact.
Well, then let's talk more about that because that's the concern expressed in your report. And you're right, we don't exactly know what's in these chemicals because it's a trade secret. Now, doesn't someone have to know? Doesn't some federal agency have to sign off on their use?
This is something we see often in the oil and gas industry. There's a number of compounds and concoctions that are more or less kept proprietary as trade secrets. It's competitive information that allows one company to get a leg up over the other. In the case of dispersants, the EPA has a handle on the main constituents of many of them. They have a list of approved dispersants, and they do go through a minor approval process. But it's not clear that they do know the name of every single compound that's in them. And when I tried to find out, I was told that that information was proprietary and unavailable.
And you spoke to people who are considered some of the foremost experts on marine biology, people like Richard Charter. What did they tell you?
Richard felt that the use of dispersants posed a great risk to marine life, and that is to say that while you may be saving birds and shorelines, it may come at the expense of sea turtles and fish populations and some of the microorganisms that feed that food chain and provide kind of the biological basis of sea life in the Gulf.
Well, the people involved in this spill say that the dispersants being used are less toxic than the ones used during the Exxon Valdez spill. But what do we know about the effects of the dispersants in that case?
There are numerous reports of illness in the community of headaches and nausea and shortness of breath and some long-term illnesses that some people associate with the use of those dispersants.
Tick through some of the different events and some of the problems that people are claiming in different areas.
The National Academy of Sciences premises their entire report with the statement that there's not quite enough known about the effect of dispersants on aquatic life. And it goes on to cite several examples, several studies that have been done. And one that I came across was a study in Coos Bay, Oregon, where dispersants and dispersed oil, the result of the dispersion process, was found in sea life there, in mussels, an indication that it could wind up in the food chain.
And what happens to seabeds? Because as you said, the dispersant breaks the oil up, but it can sometimes just drop down to the ocean floor.
What I'm told by Richard Charter is that as the oil breaks from its large globs, it can still remain in smaller globs, if you will. I'm not clear exactly what size, but these globs can settle on the ocean floor, and even as very small droplets, they can settle on the ocean floor, and they can remain there for decades, and they are then taken up by the microorganisms that feed off of the floor and again, some of the shellfish that feeds or draws its food from the ocean floor.
But as you say, I mean... this is just a lesser of two evils, a trade-off.
It was presented to me as a bit of a Damocles sword. It is generally said that the dispersants are safer to use in deep ocean environments off of the coast where their toxic effects have the opportunity to dissipate and are less likely to affect sea life and human life near the shore. The use of dispersants definitely serves an advantageous purpose. It is effective in keeping an oil slick from running ashore. It is effective biologically in terms of protecting that environment and in terms of image and public relations, in terms of making the oil slick that we're all watching every day float across the top of the Gulf of Mexico appear smaller and appear more controlled.
Well, and what would the advice be for people living along the Gulf?
The Exxon Valdez accident was the last time that dispersants were used on U.S. soil in anything close to the quantities that they're being used today. And many of the effects of their use appear to be on people who worked close to or worked with the chemicals. I think we'll learn more in the next couple of weeks as we see and hear from many of the people who are working on the cleanup process and on the spill remediation, whether they are seeing any effects from their exposure to dispersants. And those would be the people to watch in the long term as well.
Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica, the investigative online website. Abram, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter on where are we on the clergy sex abuse scandal. Also, saving the house that Ruth built. The Baltimore school where Babe Ruth learned baseball is set to close. Some people are not happy. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, is Arnold Schwarzenegger really back in movies? He's in a little film this summer. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Charles River Apparel, over a quarter century of creating apparel for corporations and athletic teams based in New England and family-owned, on Facebook at facebook.com/Charles River Apparel. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Let's take a few minutes to check in on Greece, where some protesters stormed the Acropolis earlier today. Others scuffled with police. Greeks are angry at the government's plan to slash billions of dollars from the budget by freezing wages and cutting pensions. Public sector workers began a strike today. That's expected to stretch into a nationwide general strike tomorrow. Yesterday, a group of teachers forced their way into the main state broadcaster studios in Athens to protest education cuts. And members of the Greek military staged a silent protest over having their wages cut. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant joins us from Athens. Malcolm, how tense is it there?
Things are very tense. People are, you know, very angry, and there's only a small hardcore who are involved in the violence. And so it's not as if we're about to witness a revolution.
Well, they're angry because of this deal that Greece has made with the EU in return for some help. Tell us some of the other cuts that the Greek government is planning.
The problem for the civil servants is that they work in an institution, really, which is bloated and it's inefficient, and there's a room for lots of cutting there. So all of these people who work there and have had nice cushy numbers for a long time are going to end up having their wages cut, they're going to have their pensions cut. They don't like it because nobody likes having their salaries cut, and so that's why they're complaining. And the reason why they don't like it is because they don't think that they're responsible for causing this financial crisis. It wasn't them who stole all the money, and it wasn't them who sort of were profligate. You know, they've just been paying their taxes and doing their thing, and politicians have been just massaging the figures, getting it all wrong, and now the country's in a real state.
Well, it's suggested that taxes be increased, value-added taxes, VAT taxes be increased, taxes raised on fuel, alcohol, tobacco by 10%. And we're hearing that these are hitting the lower-income Greeks the hardest.
That's one of the reasons why the sort of social divisions here are growing, because the poor think that they're bearing the brunt of it, and they think that the rich, who've been responsible for avoiding their tax for such a long time and helping to precipitate Greece into this big black hole, are not paying their fair share. And so that's why they're extremely upset.
What about the suggestion that Greece just go bankrupt?
There are lots of people on the streets who would really like that to happen, because they would think that the banks would take a bath rather than ordinary people getting hit with all these belt tightening. And what people are looking at here perhaps is 5 to 10 years of really tough times. And they're really angry with this government, because it was a socialist government that came into power just 6 months ago, promising that everything was going to be rosy in the garden. And then they took a good look at the books and discovered that they've got mathematical nightmare. And they're having to impose austerity measures that aren't the slightest bit socialist at all. And so there's real anger against politicians. And I'll give you an example. The other day, on May Day, which is the day when everybody celebrates workers' rights, there was a bit of a riot, and I got stuck in this arcade after some anarchists had burnt a state television truck. And this rather distinguished-looking gentleman came in, and he used to be the Speaker of Parliament. And he got chased into a bathroom of a cafe with shouts going, "The President of Parliament is in the toilet!" People were extremely angry at this politician, because they were saying, "You and your kind, you borrowed all this money, which has now got us into debt. You stole that money, and now you're going to get even more loans, and you're going to steal that money too." And so that's the kind of anger that they have.
Well, Malcolm Brabham, how angry are Greeks at the U.S., given that we read that Wall Street, particularly Goldman Sachs, in effect, bet on Greece to fail?
Well, the Greeks like to hate the United States, and Goldman Sachs has given them a really gold-plated reason to do that. And they really have got very little time for speculators and all these money people. But it isn't just Americans who've been speculating on their behalf. They're also extremely angry with the Germans, because the Germans have been extremely rude about the Greeks over the past few weeks, saying that they're sponges, they're idle, they're lazy, they're corrupt. But the Greeks say to the Germans, "Our economy actually wouldn't be in such a bad state if you hadn't have invaded us during the Second World War, murdered all of our people, stolen all of our money." And so it's down to that kind of level. So the European Union, which has this pretense of being this happy family of many different nations, really, you scratch the surface and there's an awful lot of anger underneath.
The BBC's Malcolm Brabant in Athens, Greece. Malcolm, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at how soap operas are changing hearts and minds in the Middle East. Here and Now. Soap operas are shaping attitudes around the world. As a recent Boston Globe article points out, soaps helped bring the birth rate in Brazil down from 6 children per woman. In Rwanda, they were credited with helping to diffuse ethnic tensions. And then there's the Turkish soap opera Gumash. Here's the theme song. Gumash, which is called Noor in Arabic, ended production in 2007, but it's still popular, not with Muslim Turks in Turkey, but outside the country in the Arab world. Nadia Bilbasi Charters is the senior U.S. correspondent for the TV network The Middle East Broadcasting Center, and she joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And tell us about the plot line of Gumash. What are we seeing in the show?
Well, it's just a typical glamorous kind of soap opera where you see a handsome man and his beautiful wife. It's a dilemma of a family that owns a business, and it's his love stories. He was forced into this arranged marriage, and then he had to make choices between his ex-lover and the new wife, who proved to be actually an asset to the company, and he's a woman of her own, very beautiful, very glamorous, very successful in her business. So it attracted so much attention in the Arab world for so many reasons. But one of the reasons is for the first time ever, they find this soap opera dealing with taboo subjects that we're not used to hear in soap operas from Syria or Egypt, which traditionally controlled the Arab market. They talk about premarital sex. They talk about gender equality treatment of women. They talked about abortion, kids born out of wedlock. It's just so many things that was refreshing and coming to the Arab world when they are on the receiving end, sitting voluntarily in their sitting rooms with their family and watching these soap operas.
Well, now, does this show also talk about love? The two main actors are incredibly photogenic. You can Google them on YouTube. We'll have something at our website, hereandnow.org. But he's a handsome leading man type, tall and blonde with just enough stubble. And she looks a little like a cross between Calista Flockhart with this huge smile and big eyes and Penelope Cruz. And they seem to be, now you said this was an arranged marriage, but they seem to be very much in love.
In the end, of course, they were in love, but in the beginning, that was not the case. And I think Mohannad, the leading character, he was not very well known in Turkey, and that's really the ironic thing. But it was the Middle East who launched him into the mega star status. Now he's called the Brad Pitt of the Middle East. But I don't think it was the storyline that attracted people. These soap operas were very candid, and they were very frank in dealing with family issues. It's an ordinary life of people. It's not an intellectual exercise in anything. Doesn't require them to think, but it is entertainment. So they sit there, they watch, they like what they see. The Turks look like Arabs because they have so many things in common, cultural and religion-wise, but also they look better than us.
Wait a second, a couple questions. You know, Arabs are looking at this, you know, blondish guy and saying he looks better than us. Is there some sort of self-judgment by Arabs?
No, but what I meant is, you know, people looking for role models, and unfortunately the blonde sells very well in the Middle East. So when you have somebody like blonde with blue eyes, then of course even the girls, they go crazy about him because he's like a rare quality. It's not the normal to see in the Middle East. So this is why they look at them and they said, they look like us actually, but slightly better.
What else does this couple do perhaps differently about their love? What other kind of message are they sending about how a man loves a woman?
Well, it's all about, you know, tender showing of emotions that sometimes you don't see on Arabic soap operas. I mean, by the way, all the kisses, I mean, you see kisses on YouTube in the Turkish version. You don't see it in Arabic because it's been censored, because the whole idea is to show it to a family. So it would be the father, the mother, the kids, and kissing or French kissing is not something that you really see on Arabic TV. You see it in movies, but not on television, where basically it's a family-oriented audience.
I have to ask then, what's left? Because from what I've seen on YouTube, all they're doing is kissing.
You can see lots of other things. You can see, for example, Mohannad, you know, apologizing to his wife when he does something wrong. He admits it's very hard for an Eastern man to admit that he's wrong. And you see this tender love, the way he looks in her eyes, the way he holds her hands, admiring her work, allowing her to work and to be a competitor and equal to him. During my research, I found that actually there were some cases that Saudi women were looking particularly up to this couple and saying, well, hold on a second. If Mohannad is a Muslim man, just like my husband, then what is it that my husband doesn't treat me the way this guy treats his wife? Now, of course, this is television and entertainment, but the bottom line is it's given examples, very subtle examples, of showing that it's not Islam really that discriminate against you. It might be the culture, it might be the man. So some were starting demanding divorce after seeing this soap opera.
Well, and there are other soap operas that are successful. Just want to touch on one, To Cry of a Stone. It's also a Turkish soap, and it talks about the daily life of Palestinians under Israeli military occupation. Now, this one seems to be, although as you say, Nur or Gumush is really getting people thinking about cultural norms, this seems to have ignited passions against Israel.
It's interesting, actually, because this political one has added a new dimension altogether, to the degree that they were forced to stop the soap opera in the 20th episode. Normally, these ones go to like 140. Nur went like 146. This one was cut really short because they came under pressure from the Israelis, the American government, and the Europeans. The interesting thing about it is done by a production company that belonged to the government. The rest of them are independent. Now, this one also trying to glamorize the role of the Ottoman Empire to show Turkey in a really positive light. So it was lots of messages. I was even surprised to see that political current affairs that happened, for example, the banning the minaret in Switzerland, was raised in the soap opera.
Comments after your article are fascinating. So some people are writing, gee, they're showing atrocities committed by Israelis against Palestinians in this soap opera, supposed to be nice and light. And others have said, well, these are Palestinians living under occupation, so that's what you'd see. But then others write back, well, wait a second, they're showing the rape of Palestinian female prisoners and organ theft. That's not true and sensationalist. And then someone else wrote back, well, wait a minute, go rent the 2000 Hollywood movie The Patriot. It claims that during the Revolutionary War, the British herded civilians into a church and burned it and them. Mm. And that never happened. And so some people are saying, well, it's a TV show, you can take license. But in such a volatile region, can a soap opera take poetic license?
Well, I agree with you. Let's not forget that soap opera is entertainment, it's television, it's not documentary, it's not real life in a way. But as I always say, there's a really thin line between fiction and reality sometimes. And when it comes to a political situation, highly explosive like the Israeli-Palestinian questions, I think it does add some kind of fuel to the fire. In the end, I don't know if it helps or doesn't, but it raises questions. It makes you think about it.
That's Nadia Bilbassi-Charters, the senior U.S. correspondent for the television network, the Middle East Broadcasting Center, or MBC. Her recent article about Turkish soaps appeared in foreignpolicy.org. We'll have it at our website, hereandnow.org. Nadia, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
The governor of California is nothing if not versatile.
Tonight, on the new dating game, you'll meet Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's been selected Mr. World 2 times, Mr. Universe 5 times, Mr. Olympia 4 times.
That was 1973, almost 10 years before Arnold became, in the order you're about to hear, Conan the Barbarian, a politician, a Simpsons joke, a kindergarten teacher, and a futuristic killing machine.
Conan, what is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
I was elected to lead, not to read.
It's not a tumor.
Hasta la vista, baby.
And just in case you thought we forgot,
I'll be back.
But will he? It's the last year of Arnold Schwarzenegger's last term as governor, and given his recent approval ratings in California, a record low 23%, he may not be back in Sacramento, but will he be back in Hollywood? Well, he already is.
Give this job to my friend here. He loves playing in the jungle, right?
Arnold Schwarzenegger has a role in a new film. It comes out in August. Joining us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles is the LA Times' Steve Zajcik. Steve, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And what is this film?
Well, this is an interesting little sort of passion project, if you will, for Sylvester Stallone, who not only stars in, I should say, but also co-wrote and directs. And what he's done here in this film called The Expendables is assemble some of his kind of old buddies, his action film buddies, whether it's Bruce Willis or Terry Crews, Mickey Rourke, and of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger, along with a few younger stars, to kind of tell this sort of familiar tale about a group of mercenaries who go and fight and try to overthrow a South American despot. The plot details almost don't matter, I think. What does matter is that you get to see some, you know, 50 and 60 something year old men put on the tank tops and lace up the old bullet belts and see if they can create some mayhem that might have been a little bit more appropriate back in 1985.
Was it you who called them big screen graybeards?
Yes, this is the kind of film that if you were casting a movie at a kind of action actor retirement home, this is the film you'd end up with.
Well, we found a trailer and we want to play a little more of his part. Well, actually, this may be his entire part. It's the same line. He's speaking to Bruce Willis's character, and he's referring to Sylvester Stallone's character. Let's listen again to what we think may be the extent of Arnold Schwarzenegger's speaking part in The Expendables. Let's listen.
Give this job to my friend here. He loves playing in the jungle.
That's it, right?
That is it. And it was really more of a goof and a kind of favor he did for Stallone. The reference, of course, Stallone, the star of Rambo, a number of films that were shot and set in the jungle. And I think what Schwarzenegger is really doing is kind of saying, he's kind of teasing us a little bit. He's saying, you know, I'll do a favor for Stallone, get people wondering if I'm going to come back to Hollywood, but I'm not going to give them too much to really feed off. But he sort of leaves the possibility sufficiently open where you kind of say, maybe he will be back. Maybe this is just an entree into a bigger role down the line.
With all the problems in California, might this add to his, you know, unpopularity rating if people are thinking he's off putting together a movie instead of taking care of those problems?
Well, you know, it's funny. When he first went to shoot this movie, it was, I think, about 8-10 months ago, and there was a lot of questioning from some of the Sunday morning talk shows and some other reporters saying, wait a second, there is a huge budgetary crisis going on in California. There's a crisis of education. Your approval ratings are plummeting. Is this the best time to be going off and doing it? And he kind of made a little joke and said, you know, well, I'll take my fees and, you know, apply it to the state budget, or he let others make that joke for him. At the same time, like any other lame duck elected official, you know, he leaves office at the end of the year. This movie comes out in August. There's not really much the public can do except maybe not buy tickets to the film to really register their objection. So there's not really a lot of downside for him politically or as far as his image goes.
What is the industry saying about this new film possibly being a trial balloon in the sense that he might have that people want him back in the movies?
You know, it's very interesting. When I first started reporting this piece, I expected, you know, most of the people in Hollywood who I talked to say, you know what, yeah, Schwarzenegger, he was great in the 80s, but he hasn't really been a box office draw. He did a couple of movies in the late 90s that utterly bombed, movies like The Sixth Day and Collateral Damage, which no one but the most fanatical Schwarzenegger purists will remember. He did Terminator 3, but that was almost a nostalgia play. But I expected most people in Hollywood to say, you know what, he's moved on now. There's not going to be a lot of interest on our part. There's not necessarily a lot of interest on the audience's part. But most people were saying, you know what, we would welcome him back. We might not make a $150 million action movie and build it around him. But most people that I talked to said, you know what, as either a supporting character in a bigger film or a lead character in a more modestly budgeted film, we would have interest to cast Schwarzenegger. So, you know, I think it's still up to the governor as to what he wants to do. But as far as whether Hollywood and the industry is willing to welcome him with open arms, I don't think there's any doubt that they are.
But does that hurt his future political aspirations? And some might say, where does he go from here? Well, there is, you know, possible senatorship. Does going to movie making mean he's not going to go there?
You know, I think one of the most salient things that was said to me as I was reporting this piece came from Joe Klein at Time Magazine, who, when I asked him, I said, well, you've covered a lot of these politicians who've kind of jumped to entertainment, entertainers who've jumped to politics. And he said, you know, almost inevitably when a politician leaves office, they try to do something completely apolitical because they try to, what they really want to do is ingratiate themselves or re-ingratiate themselves with the American public. And, you know, there's really no better way to do that these days than star in a big budget kind of populist film. You know, sure, he can write a book, he can go on a speaking tour, he can kind of take the sort of high road of the sort of public ambassador the way Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush have done. But if he wanted to reestablish himself, you know, among a public that, at least here in California, he's fallen very much out of favor with, a career or at least a short stopover in the film business is probably the best way to do it.
Well, you've speculated on some of the roles he might take. What are they?
Well, you know, a lot of people say, you know, an action role would be kind of his bread and butter. And I think in that case, it would be kind of an older man sort of mental role in an action film. One thinks of what Harrison Ford did with Shia LaBeouf in the Indiana Jones sequel a few years ago. I think there's also a possibility that he could do some kind of comedic role. You know, he had a little run there where he did some movies with Ivan Reitman. He did Twins, most famously, did Kindergarten Cop. He did Junior. He certainly has a propensity for comedy, if only because people are laughing a little bit at him as much as they are with him. It would certainly be a smart move for him, and I think that road would be open to him.
Well, I'm just wondering if you think that Arnold Schwarzenegger might be trying to re-enter films at the worst possible time. We've spoken to you before about how Hollywood's turning to cheaper ways of making films, remakes and sequels, and he's, you know, a big budget guy, and California has a $23 billion budget shortfall. We know it's affected the University of California's college system. Has it trickled down to Hollywood, and might this not be the right time for an Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, that's exactly right. And I think there is a huge irony in him trying to re-enter the business at this time because, you know, the whole culture that he grew out of, you know, kind of in the late 80s and early 90s, as far as film financing goes, as far as box office goes, was very much about, you know, establish a leading man and then milk him for all he's worth. And you could slot him into action movies. You could slot him into comedies. You can pretty much do no wrong. Those days are gone. I think that's hard for even the biggest A-listers to do. That's hard for Brad Pitt to do. It's certainly going to be hard for Arnold Schwarzenegger to do. So right now, the vogue in Hollywood, as you say, is very much to take someone less expensive and kind of build them up. And let's not forget, there are a ton of other Arnold movies from the 80s that did stupendously well, that have tremendous amount of brand recognition, and that, let's face it, the kids today, from everything I've reported on, still like Arnold, still quote him. I mean, I was at a panel with McGee, who directed the last Terminator movie, and there were teens wearing Arnold costumes and quoting him. So I think if you
You're
were
kidding.
Making, They were, and someone even got on stage and kind of did a, you know, an hasta la vista, baby, I'll be back thing. And McGee said, I'm casting you in my next film. So, you know, there's a lot of love and goodwill for Arnold, not in the state of California, not among voters in the state of California, but certainly among film fans and even younger film fans. And I think that if any one of those 80s hits get remade from Conan on out, like a Predator, you know, movies that did perfectly well back in the day, there's probably a place in those films for Arnold as well, if he should want it.
That's the LA Times' Steve Zeitchik speaking from the Marketplace Studios in LA. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.